Hello, everyone. I am Esther from Pink Life Association, and I will be chairing today's second panel on Trans Pockets, which is titled as Trans Queering Public Museums and Memories. We will keep the order that we have in the program, in the written program even. So we will start with AC Panella with Scars Make the Body More Interesting, Trans Collective. So each speaker will have 20 minutes. And then after that, we will have a half an hour discussion for all of us. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm not loud enough. To give a little bit of context to this presentation, I want to introduce myself and kind of the broad topic and start by being very clear about this is a new topic and kind of a disciplinary shift in the work that I've been doing. So I'm a dyke-identified trans man from California. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, but I do my scholarship in Ohio right now, so it's a very interesting combination of urban and not urban. And my overall research, or what I'm working towards, is what it looks like to have collective trauma and collective memory within trans communities, and what that scholarship looks like. So what I'm going to present today is the beginning of what this scholarship is, and kind of a small slice into what I've been thinking of as the state of the union for trans collective memory in the United States right now, meaning what are we representing, what are we showing, what are we distributing in terms of trans identity. So I called this presentation Scars Make Your Body More Interesting because, as many of us already know, when it comes to representing trans identities in public spaces, we're really suturing together a bunch of histories. The archives are really coming together, and getting representation in museum spaces has been a particularly difficult moment, not just getting bodies in there and artists into spaces, but then if we do have bodies and artists in those spaces, what's being distributed, right? What messages are being shown? And I think that this is particularly important because it starts to help those of us who are trans-identified make meaning of our world, and if these are the images, then we need to start, as particularly museum scholars, saying, what are we showing, so that we know what we're not showing. That said, I'm in my first year of my PhD program, so if you're looking for collaboration or need an intern, I gotta do some work. So just keep that in mind. So with that, I wanna start by saying I'm really also excited to be presenting today because today is an anniversary of an uprising, and I haven't heard anybody talk about it yet, so it's super exciting. And I mention that because this particular uprising, I think, is one that shows and highlights why we need to be looking at trans identity and collective memory. And I'll do this by sharing my collective memory, or my particular memory, around the Stonewall uprising. I want you to picture it. Panella. I'm a baby gay, right? Very young, and I'm hanging out with some queer elders. And we're talking about Pride, and they say, well, do you know the origin of Pride? And I say, we're gay, right? Isn't that all we need to know? And they say, no, Judy Garland, right? If you don't know who Judy Garland is, she's kind of like Lady Gaga, but from a different era. So I say this because what I was told was Judy Garland died June 22nd, right? And when she passed away, queers in New York were so distraught, they spent the next week drinking themselves. Now, when I first heard this, I was like, that seems ridiculous. But then when David Bowie died, I'm telling you, I was like, I get it, right? I am there. So Judy Garland passes away. There is a raid on the Stonewall Inn, and what I am told is that this is the moment when gays and lesbians fight back. I added lesbians, I'll be clear with you, the person who told me the story did not include lesbians in that, right? Just told me a bunch of gay men kind of uprose. So now, time moves forward. I start being more active in the queer community. And thanks to the wonderful work of people, like many of the people who are here, we start to have oral histories and archives and stories about what actually happened at the Stonewall Inn on this famous day. And we start to see our transcestors, right? Sylvia Rivera, right? Marsha P. Johnson. We start to hear, and this is the next thing that I was told, depending on who told it to me, one or the other was the first to take off her high heel and chuck it at the police. I also love that visual imagery just as much as I love Judy Garland, right? Like, this is a great moment. But I want to be clear that I went on also believing that that is the origin story for the Stonewall Uprising. And even more recently, right, we've started to talk about the fact that the person who may have thrown the first punch or first brick is actually Storm DeLavier, right? A biracial, masculine-presenting lesbian. Why do I start off with this memory? In my life, what Stonewall has been has changed very dramatically, right, in terms of what it means. It started with a story that very frankly excluded my particular gender identity, right? And as it's moved forward, and what we understand about who was there and how things started to happen, we started to see more inclusion of particularly trans identity. That is a moment of important and particular shifts for us, right? In our earlier opening session, Sani Esch challenged us to think about whose memories we highlight and why. And I think that when we start to talk about collective memory, that this is one of our particular challenges. How do we start to incorporate and support activists who are challenging some particularly systemic issues, right? And I do want to say that because I'm going to take a moment to kind of give an asterisk and talk about language. I'm going to use the phrase trans right now as kind of a bigger, broad umbrella term to also include folks who are gender expansive, gender non-binary, or maybe have some kind of non-binary, culturally driven gender identity, right? And so I'm using kind of trans broadly. So you'll excuse me if that gets a little clunky at times. So now, why have I started off talking about Stonewall? Well, I think that Stonewall is an important point for us because it is something that has expanded in terms of relevance. We know that there were uprisings that predate Stonewall in the US. We can talk about Compton's Cafeteria, we can talk about Cooper's Donuts, we can talk about the Black Cat, right? We can talk about these other moments, but for some reason, this is a particular moment that tends to be placed in the heart of our memory. So, what I want to do now is take a moment to talk about what kind of cultural memory is, right? And why I've started to talk about this historical moment and really turn to kind of the materiality, right? If this is how we start to look at and understand trans identity in history, then how do we start to present that in US museum spaces, in archives and gallery spaces, and how do we work to incorporate those elements of trans identity that really reflect the kind of contemporary cultural memory? One of the things that we know is that there has been an increase in particularly the collection of materials related to trans identity. So being able to see oneself in everyday objects and ephemera is starting to be a little bit more expansive. There are clearly artists who are doing a wide variety of work, whether it's in film or dance or other kinds of cultural moments, but how are those artists actually starting to be out there? Hallbachs argues that cultural memory endures and draws strength from its base in a coherent body of people, and its individuals as group members who remember. So for those of us who are trans, right, there's this particular moment around how we start to remember our own history in the stories that we tell each other and how we present those stories. Collections, the things that we're collecting, matter, right?
because of what we've seen. Collections, right, can become archive, and archive starts to become canon. Things that we think that are true kind of indefinitely, and we pass that truth on. According to Armstrong and Craig, scholars of collective memory recognize that production and maintenance of collective memory requires human activity, means we have to be doing something about it. And actors are unlikely to engage in memory work unless they identify the event as worthy of commemoration. Well, that's a particular poignant moment, right? Something that is worthy of commemoration. For those of us who have been trans-identified and pushed to the margins, right, how we start to acknowledge what is important and are we holding on to what's important is difficult. In an earlier panel this week, we've talked about issues of what happens if you're somebody who is displaced based on your gender identity. You don't have the materiality to keep things up. You may not have the materiality to hold on to or even document activities as they're happening. So what have we been doing right now? What I've been looking at right now is, what are we currently writing about and talking about in terms of museum studies and archives? What are we currently presenting? With the hope that we can start to see where we might fill in some of the gaps, right? Again, because archive becomes canon, analyzing what is happening is also a way of noting what tropes or stereotypes we are offering to ourselves so that we can challenge those tropes and stereotypes. Now, one of the first problems that comes along with this for those of us who are creating archives is the issue of labeling, right? Too often, we wind up going back because we may not have access to those specific individuals and relabeling folks to try to fit them in with a current moment or current language that we have, and that does us some injustice in some ways. Now, it does help bring some visibility, but at the same time, it may not necessarily do or honor the person that we are referencing. So when we look to larger archives, what we really still are seeing in the literature is that archives are being talked about very broadly with LGBT or queer, right? And what we don't see in those archives as much, although we know it's increasing, right, is kind of the T. So we see a lot of archival material focused around L, G, and B, less focused on T, although we know that that's changing. What I found in the current writing are three particular themes, right? The first is, in terms of trans and archive, this is one of the first big things that we're seeing. When we look at where trans identity is being represented in museum studies literature, is in the archive, right? Next, what we're starting to see is when we do talk about trans bodies in museum studies, there is a focus on body, right? And not necessarily an individual. And what I mean by that is that there's kind of this dissociation in presentation, right? We don't necessarily talk about other individual traits. We tend to talk about the process of transition. And then the third thing that we start to see is where do and how do we house trans memorabilia, ephemera, etc., and where should it be displayed? So, first, the archive. For trans folks, I dare say, as we heard in the first panel, that we're kind of in a golden era for archive, right? The internet really has changed a lot of things. We are able to have more access to different trans archives than we've ever seen before. And a lot of the work is being done here, whether it's the Trans Digital Archive, the Transgender Archive in BC, the Louise Lawrence Archive, and then the Trans Latina Archives that are happening in Chile and Brazil and Argentina right now. There's some really wonderful work being done, and I am thankful for that work. However, there's still a tension of collecting this archive material, and where should we put this archive material? Should it stay within trans-specific spaces, or should it start to connect to larger queer movements? This is a tension that queer museums and archives have struggled with, right? Do we start to move into state institutions, et cetera? And that's a conversation that I think people are still moving through and having to decide for themselves. This is all to say that I'm actually really thankful for the work that archivists are doing right now. I think it's a really important process. I'm not trying to diminish that work. But this starts to lead to what's happening in terms of this second and third theme that we see in the literature right now. The next thing that we start to look at is the issue of, once we have trans identity, we have trans ephemerae, what is starting to be presented, and how is that starting to be presented? So, some of you may have seen these particular sculptures before. So that's Buck Angel and Alana Starr, two porn stars, right? Hey yo. It wouldn't be a good presentation without a little porn, right? And these sculptures were done by Mark Quinn, who is an artist. And I think that these particular sculptures are interesting until you read the artist's statement. Right, oh, I know. So, this work is studying people who have chosen to redefine their outward identity using excessive surgery. Okay, so not great, right? I think we can agree. If you look at what the other sculptures are that go along with this particular image, you're going to notice that they're all marginalized individuals, including trans individuals. This is one of the pieces that has gotten the most write-ups in terms of art criticism and media studies, right? So when we talk about trans bodies, this is the kind of thing that we're seeing. These are not necessarily full people, right? And they're people who are chosen based on kind of a sense of exoticism, particularly given U.S.'s particular cultural relationship to pornography, right? So there's an exoticism that's within that. So I bring up these things, this idea of how we present the body, how we talk about the body, and how we're starting to archive material, because I think that we're at a place now where, in terms of trans identity, we have some space to make some interventions, and I want to share with you some interventions that are happening, right? Because we are in this great place. One of the first that many of us probably know is MOTHA, the Museum of Trans Herstory and Art. This is a project by Chris Vargas, and I'm going to show you two slides that Chris has produced. I really like this slide from 2013 that talks about trans folk who are currently incarcerated or at risk of being incarcerated, the amount of trans folk who identify as artists, and then finally the amount of trans folks who are represented in museum shows, right? This became part of the impetus to create MOTHA in some ways, and MOTHA is a pop-up organization that merely by existing clearly shot trans representation in museums through the roof. Now, I'm going to talk more about it in a second, because the cool thing about MOTHA is that it's a pop-up museum, so it doesn't necessarily have a permanent home, but it is a traveling process, and that, I think, is one way to start to introduce this idea of archive and artivism into spaces that are very visible. The next thing, of course, is something that maybe folks saw. I really appreciated this, which is the Queer Archives Institute at the Shules. If you were here on Wednesday, you may have had a chance to wander through. And Carol Radrowski, who helps curate this, if you go through the exhibit in the way that it's ordered, you end on a narrative of a trans woman. And it's the oldest trans woman, or at least, as far as we know, the oldest trans woman in Croatia. And I really appreciated that that's how that particular moment ended, because when we talk about things like representation of trans identities, remember, we focus on bodies, right? Like what it looks like to transition. What we don't talk about is, like, aging, right? Now, I've got other theories about that, but we'll ignore that for now. And we can also start to do things with our own curation in larger institutions. If you are in California between now and the end of August, I encourage you to come to Oakland, because I have to tell you that this is possibly one of the best queer exhibitions I've ever seen. The exhibition is called Queer California, and it's the idea of retelling stories. Now, the cool thing about this is that it's really based on geography in California, so it doesn't necessarily cover all of California. It's focused on three major areas, the San Francisco Bay Area, Los Angeles, and San Diego. It's kind of skipping over some rural identity, but that's okay. And what the curator who worked on this project did was really work to make sure that through each of those narratives, trans identity was interwoven. And as you can see in the background, she brought MOTHA to this particular exhibit. Now, who you see there are, I mentor a group of about 20 to 30 trans-identified youth. And this is a small collection who is willing to be photographed, who I took to see this particular exhibit. In the back, you see them with Mother. And in the front, you see them playing this great board game that's kind of like a queer version of Trivial Pursuit. And it's a really entertaining game. It also has like other elements. So there's like a physical challenge called Group Grope that I think everybody would really appreciate. But I want to show you this particular moment because in this game, my students were asked, these students that I'm working with were asked questions about Stonewall and other important queer moments. And they got them wrong. And they got them wrong because the history has changed, right? They got the answers right, in my opinion. But because the way that they have been exposed to what trans identity is, what queer culture is, has shifted over time, they were able to experience that a little bit differently. And I'm really appreciative of that because since we are on this theme of Stonewall today, I'm gonna turn to a quote by Miss Major, which says, "Our visibility is marvelous, and who knew it would turn out like this?" Thank you.
Thank you very much, AC, for the great presentation. And now I invite Yutaka Kubo from Watabe University, Japan, to present Excavating the Untouched Memories, Challenges of Displaying Homoerotic Collections at the Tsuboichi Memorial Theater Museum.
Right, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Yutaka Kubo. I'm an assistant professor of film studies at Waseda University. I'm very excited to be in this conference and take part in this panel. So in this presentation, I will discuss the obstacles that our museum is facing in preparing for Spring 2020 special exhibition on retracing and reimagining the Japanese film history from the 1950s to the 2010s from a perspective of queer film studies. Since the preparation for this exhibition is still at an early stage, I won't be able to give you details of what it looks like. I won't give able to give you the pictures, but instead I will share the context as to why we believe it is necessary to have an exhibition focusing on gender expressions and same-sex intimacy and desires in Japanese film history that have not been told through a heteronormative narrative, and these issues are the issues that we need to examine at the museum located on the university campus. So first let me give you the brief introduction of our museum. The Tsuboichi Memorial Theater Museum, often called Enpaku, celebrated its 90th anniversary last year. It was first founded in 1928 to celebrate the complete translation of all the Shakespeare plays into Japanese by Professor Shoyo Tsuboichi, and which is the guy on the left, back there. And and who taught English at Waseda University. And he was interested in a wide range of performances and arts from kabuki, European theater plays, music, films, literature, fashion, and so on. Therefore, he decided that the museum would collect materials from all over the world as much as possible. With more than 10 million materials in number, the museum has played a central and crucial role in Japan in offering visitors, students, and scholars educational programs and exhibitions, as well as research platforms for decades. And every year, there are two special exhibitions curated by researchers at the museum. And for instance, the special exhibition last year focused on the dynamics of interrelations of theater companies between the 1960s and 2010s in Japan. And for Spring 2010, I was asked to take a lead in making possible an exhibition on representation of LGBTQ characters in contemporary popular culture in Japan as a way to promote the presence of the university as an educational institution that emphasizes the value of diversity in upcoming 2000 Tokyo Olympic Games. Yeah. And at first, I refused to be part of this political exploitation of sexual minorities for promoting whatever diversity the university has in its mind. However, since all the young researchers are contracted for only 3 years, and this year being my second year at the museum, I was afraid that the museum might never have a chance to do an exhibition that reimagines the Japanese visual culture from a queer perspective if I miss this opportunity. So after considering for a few weeks, I said yes, only under the condition that the exhibition shows no association with the Tokyo Olympic Games and that it would focus on how changes in social cultural discourses about gender expressions and same-sex desires, intimacy, have been reflected in contemporary Japanese visual culture, mainly cinema. Yes. Thank you. So the reason why I said yes to be part of this exhibition is that I want to make even a small contribution to making the museum a kind of safe space for university students, no matter what their gender identity or sexual orientation is. And the context behind my motivation is the emergence of the so-called LGBT boom in Japan that is said to have started since the early 2010s and bloomed in 2015 after the legalization of same-sex marriage in the U.S. Since then, some critiques and some cities and districts started to implement same-sex partnerships, including schemes and discussions on equal rights for sexual minorities, including same-sex marriage, have been widely expanding, and there is also the proliferation of LGBTQ characters in movies and TV dramas, though mostly gay men and trans women. On one hand, we are happy about changes that we are seeing, but on the other hand, I cannot stop thinking, is Japanese society really changing into a world in which, say, two men can hold their hands in daylight, or trans people can use their bathroom of their preference without being afraid of the violence? So this is a campaign for the same-sex marriage in Japan. Okay. And in August 2018, a member of Liberal Democratic Party, lawmaker Mio Sugita, said that the Japanese government does not need to spend taxes to implement care and legal protections for sexual minorities because they cannot bear offspring and thus are quote-unquote unproductive. A wide range of people, including queer theorists, sociologists of gay and lesbian studies, and sexual minority groups, criticized her homophobic comment, for which she has not yet apologized to this date. Her comment unfortunately exemplifies and points to strong homophobia and heterosexism that exist at the core of Japanese society, and this homophobia is threatening lives of queer youth on university campus every day. In 2015, a graduate student at Hitotsubashi University in Tokyo committed a suicide weeks after being outed by his friend. Despite the increasing visibility of sexual minorities in media, queer youth in Japan are thriving and surviving in this heteronormative society, just like youth in any other countries. In an article, At the Basis of Difficulties in Lives of LGBT+, Ken Suzuki, a professor at Meiji University, shares comments left in an examination paper by one of his students. A sense of emptiness and loneliness overwhelms me whenever I think about the fact that I will not be able to experience life events such as marriage and childbirth. If I come out, it may rather ease me, but I am afraid of being treated coldly by people around me by doing so. The student continues to address their fear of being discriminated as well as of not being able to find ways to lead a happy life in the future, suggesting that queer youth in Japan are still exhausted in this homophobic and heteronormative society. So, despite being the first and only university in Japan with gender and sexuality center, situations for students at Waseda University are not optimistic either. Therefore, through collaboration with Gender and Sexuality Center, our museum aims to improve a learning environment on campus through Spring 2020 special exhibition that will be our first attempt to even recognize the presence of materials untouched before from a queer perspective. So what kind of exhibitions are we planning? Its primary focus will be based on the reconstructing the Japanese film history from a queer point of view, making connections with other neighboring media such as theater performances and television, reimagining and recreating movie theater spaces where people enjoyed cinematic expressions of same-sex desire and queer intimacy in the 1980s and 1990s, and forming a kind of a safe space for visitors to take a moment and think about representations of gender and sexuality in contemporary media. At the moment, we are still brainstorming ideas and thinking carefully about the ways in which we build a welcoming space for students and visitors and other people, you know, who are interested in this exhibition. And that's something that I liked suggestions and advice from a floor. And in terms of cinema-related collections, peripheral materials such as press sheet, pamphlets, help us reimagine an attitude toward same-sex desires and intimacy at a specific time. And this is a movie called Section Cho by Keisuke Kinoshita, and it is said that this is the first mainstream commercial Japanese film that talked about gay and lesbian sexuality. And and we have more than 6,000 movie pamphlets, some of which include imported gay films in the 1980s and early 1990s. At the same period, the Japanese film industry started to see films dealing with lesbian intimacy. One of the filmmakers in focus is Shiori Kazama, most of whose films depict female intimacy and lesbianism. Despite her contribution to paving the way for subsequent filmmakers dealing with same-sex intimacy between women, she has been virtually underappreciated and overlooked in the Japanese film history, often written by men. And in discussing earlier example of gay men represented in Japanese cinema, the exhibition will take a close look at the legacy of director Satoru Kobayashi. Kobayashi is most famous for his contribution to sustaining the Japanese film industry in 1960s and 1970s at difficult times by making hundreds of films with softcore erotic scenes, so it's just pink films. And such films depicting heterosexual relationships are just called pink films, but he also worked extensively on softcore gay pink films called Barazok films from 1984 to the late 1990s. Barazok films was a genre that allowed cinematic representation of gay men and that were hardly seen in mainstream media, and it also enabled filmmakers to explore social issues that sexual minorities faced in the 1980s and 1990s, such as HIV and AIDS crisis. After Kobayashi passed away in 2001, his film-related materials were donated to a museum in 2007 because he graduated from Waseda University. The information that the donation consisted of 60mm films, movie scripts, and production notes like this was cataloged in a database, but since none of the previous film researchers in the museum was interested in his materials, the details remained unknown for 12 years. A further investigation needs to be taken, but I have found out that production notes here contain valuable insights into the production process that seem to echo, for instance, the social atmosphere of discrimination and homophobia during the AIDS crisis in the movie such as White Rose of Santa Monica, depicting an interracial relationship in the 1990s. This finding helps us see how Barazok films or gay softcore pink films, marginalized from mainstream media, were more flexible in terms of telling stories about marginalized men. I recently learned that during this 12-year span of blankness, there were a few incidents where Kobayashi's scripts, I think it was this one and these ones, they were almost discarded because of homoerotic content. And if it had been done so, we couldn't have discovered an aesthetic, social, cultural, and possibly political significance of Barazok films. And this incident sheds light on one of the challenges that we face at the museum in preparing for a special exhibition. The challenge is how to deal with the rhetoric of "we have never done that before." And such rhetoric prevents from seeking any possibility, and I hear it from people both inside and outside the museum. Whenever I say something, they say, "well, we've never done that before." So. Okay, so therefore we need to establish a firm ground in order to let people realize the necessity of making this exhibition happen in today's context and know that the museum is ready to do something related to issues of gender expressions and same-sex desires as well as intimacy. So one of the most obvious solutions I came up with is educating people inside and outside the museum and let them know that thinking about history and situations that queer youth are facing on today's university campus is urgent. So for educational purpose, we plan two events where we invite guests with experiences in dealing with queer memories, film archives and lectures on social discourses on LGBTQ plus issues. One of them is an upcoming event in July called One on the Right. It's called Rainbow Over Empaku, Essentials of LGBTQ Histories. And the other one is an international symposium that we held in January 2019 called Excavating Queer Memories through Visual Media and Archives. And for this event, we invited two speakers. One of them was Mitsuyo Wada-Marciano, a professor of film studies at Kyoto University, who used to work at Kyoto University, so some of you may know, who shared her research on the historical development of film archives in Japan and pointed out how erotic, especially homoerotic films, have been excluded from the subjects of archiving at National Film Archive of Japan. The other guest speaker was Stu Maddox on behalf of GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco. Stu made a documentary called Real in the Closet, using footage of horror movies collected across North America. Despite horror movie making being a privileged medium for heterosexual families historically, excavating horror movies made by members of queer communities is really encouraging in the sense that it visually brings back our past to the present as well as to the future. And meeting with Stu actually led me to apply for this conference. So I'd like to use this opportunity to thank Stu and Terry Beswick and Gerald Koskovic from GLBT Historical Society. Thank you. And many questions were raised at this symposium, but two questions in particular remain challenging. The colors are gone, so I'm sorry. But one is age restriction. In Japan, one needs to be above 18 years old to access sexually explicit content, and most of the content of the exhibition will not include nudity or explicit elements, but some do. Since the museum is open to the public too, we need to come up with solutions or a certain attitude we need to equip ourselves with. And I'm hoping that the panel, youth exhibition and sex education in the next session may give me some ideas. And the other challenge is interpretation of certain text. And since I'm a film scholar, I can stay bold and strong to introduce queer reading of some film texts. But in order to talk about queer aspects of Japanese film history, we cannot ignore the influence of kabuki. And kabuki is a traditional Japanese theater form that invites discussions about same-sex desires and presence of trans people in theater. However, Japanese studies is a hotbed of homophobia and transphobia, and because of our museum being one of the central platforms for studies of kabuki in Japan, it seems difficult to even start such a discussion in a specific in a special exhibition. And I've been trying this for months, but my boss doesn't say yes. So, okay. So in conclusion, our museum has a long way to go in terms of excavating queer memories untouched before and addressing the urgency of looking into such memories in today's context of the LGBT boom. doing the special exhibition on queer memories in Japanese film history may open up a possibility of turning the museum into a sort of safe space. But the special exhibition lasts only for half a year, and no researcher and no curator are hired permanently in this at this museum. So excavating and sustaining the presence of queer memories in the museum will remain extremely hard, but we must keep on trying. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Yutaka, for the presentation. And now I invite B. Kaminga, a postdoctoral fellow in African Center for Migration and Society, WITS University South Africa, to present What is Private About Private Parts? Archives, Opacity, Tabloids, and Transgender Lives on and off the African Continent.
Hi, hello. So I am from South Africa. I work largely with transgender refugees and asylum seekers from the African continent. I recently published my first book about trans refugees living in South Africa. And now I've started a new project with people who've left the continent and are living in the global north, but are producing particular kinds of digital content quite actively and projecting that back at the continent to undo the narrative of trans denialism that is quite pervasive across the African continent. Much of this archive exists online, and I have and continue to struggle with the ways in which I can use it. So I have come to this presentation with more questions than answers, just FYI. So in 2004, two seemingly unconnected events took place. The first iteration of what would quickly become the biggest trans beauty pageant in the world took place in Thailand. And thousands of kilometers away, a trans woman left Nigeria believing that if she stayed any longer, her next suicide attempt would be her final. And she made her way to the UK. 7 years later, and the words, I am contestant number two, and I'm presenting the giant of Africa and Nigeria, would be heard across that same stage. This day was not only significant for the pageant, which had never had an entrant from the African continent in its history, it had also never crowned a black woman, but it was significant for this refugee who was living in the UK, who was initially from Abuja, because she chose this moment to identify herself quite publicly as transgender and Nigerian. As a strong contender in the pageant, she created a lot of media attention and subsequently has become known in Nigeria as Nigeria's first transgender. I don't know how much you know about Miss International Queen, but it is considered one of the biggest trans beauty pageants in the world. It's streamed live over 5 days. When Miss Sahara took part, she competed against 22 people. She tells me that she was kind of told on the side that although she could have won, it would be very difficult for them to crown a woman of color the first time she entered, so she was crowned first princess instead. The pageant has this year crowned its first black queen, so quite a number of years later. What I think is important about Miss International Queen is in the promotional video when Miss Sahara walks out, she uses very stereotypical African pictures, so there's like huts, there's leopards running in the background, but importantly, the green and white of the Nigerian flag is behind her, and she actively chose that. She could have chosen which country to represent, and she chose Nigeria. So for her, she says this moment was important because she was sick of being told that trans people don't exist in Nigeria. And in fact, when she did get crowned, the Nigerian cultural minister was asked, do you know about this trans Nigerian who's being crowned in this competition? And he responded that if she's trans, she can't be Nigerian, and if she's Nigerian, she can't be trans. So she says that wearing this banner or sash names Nigeria, I'm making a statement saying I'm here, I am proud, I am a transgender woman, and this is who I am. You say it doesn't exist in Nigeria. It does exist. They see it as immoral and wrong, and I feel we've been given a great opportunity here at Miss International Queen to celebrate ourselves as trans women. And this is from a documentary series called Lady Boys, which is shown on Sky, and currently it is the most watched episode of any show that Sky has ever produced. So thus far, when we think about the African Trans Archive, that's a bit weird. It has best been described by this article by Liesl Turan and Ricky Kohositau, who were both directors of the first trans organization on the African continent, Gender Dynamics, and they have described it as a vacuum. When we consider Africa and when you hear that word in relation to LGBT people, the first words that come to mind are abomination, un-African, sin, Western import, et cetera, penal code. Words we don't hear are joy, survival, sexual pleasure, and celebration. One of the ways that scholars and artists have tried to push back against this is obviously to look to the colonial archive and the pre-colonial archive and to kind of attempt to prove that gender nonconformity and different versions of sexual orientation have always existed. When we look to this grassroots trans archive, what we see is that it's mostly made up of physical and official documents related to NGOs. It doesn't actually, even though this article came out in 2015, it doesn't mention any trans people apart from activists currently on or off the continent. So at this point, we already had Titika in Angola, who identifies as a transsexual woman and became a UNHCR ambassador for Angola. And she's a musician in a very strange moment in Angola's kind of popular cultural history. Their kind of answer to why this archive is so, it's very brief, and why it's so English and Southern African focused is to say that there's been a history of confusion around gender identity on the African continent and around sexual orientation, and the documentation of trans lives then has been quite difficult. And I think, you know, we can accept this critique up until a point, and often at conferences I get asked this question about, like, but have you done the history of whether these people existed on the continent? And I'm like, sure, plenty of people have done that history, but I think we need to start acknowledging that people are living now anyway. Trans people are now living on the African continent, whether we think they were there historically or not. And so those people's archives are beginning to be very important, because if we say that colonial archives are something that we have to look to and not use the language for given representation, then these people are actually using particular kinds of language and saying this existence is happening. So, yeah. So what happened when Sahara won was that a number of news articles started being produced in Nigeria, and there's been a kind of trend around, so if you type in Nigerian transgender, this is some of the stuff that comes up. Most often the newspapers talk about Nigeria's top 10 transgenders. A lot of it is quite traumatic. These are some of the softer ones that I could actually use. But you can kind of see from the content that they're quite problematic. And so I have a struggle with how to use these. And it is as much about their content as it is about my own power as a person who might bring this kind of tabloid into validity in the academic space. And I think that there's a relationship here between Sahara's archive and intentionality and representation and kind of past, present, and future. Joan Swartz and Terry Cook pointed out in 2002 in their challenges to those using archives in their work and archivists themselves, if we choose not to engage in debates regarding power and its impact, it is in fact a strong choice in favor of the status quo with all its implications for buttressing mainstream power. So the images, and I think this kind of touches on AC's opening, the images we see and the way that she's spoken about it, there's quite a clear obsession with her body. And a kind of overly exaggerated and simplified traits. Stuart Hall, so I've turned, obviously, in my confusion to a lot of people, so you're going to hear a lot of name dropping, sorry. Archives are not inert historical collections. They always stand in an active dialogue in relation to questions which the present puts to the past, and the present always puts its questions differently for each generation. The archive has to be rich, varied, and in a sense eclectic enough to bear the weight of different contested interpretations and to allow them to battle out their differences in relation to different texts and intertexts with the archive, which the archive itself makes available. So the question then to me became, is this archive eclectic enough to take on this battle? And that's a very definite no. So Dipesh Chakrabarti talks about how the people that are excluded from history are the people that are immediately framed as mad. So madmen don't write history. And we see, particularly with trans women and trans women of color, that more and more increasingly we either don't talk about it or we know about it but don't want to write about it, that they are framed in a way that suggests they were kooky, they were a bit disruptive, there was perhaps a sense of madness to them, which begins to kind of undo their political work and even their activist histories. And we can go into a whole kind of discussion around the pressures for trans people to survive in society, et cetera, et cetera. But these are the things that kind of undo the validity of these archives in a public space. And we see that happening with Zahara's archive. So there's a very clear kind of idea that she's either taken on this like Western-induced idea of gender confusion, or at worst, she's succumbed to a kind of pure madness. So for me, then, this archive is of critical importance to both the African continent, but particularly trans women of color coming from the continent. But I have several ethical issues with it, and I can only go into two here. So the first, dead naming. So many of the headlines, not even the content, if I were to cite a headline, it would have her dead name in it. And it got me thinking about what we do with dead names and how we know trans people's dead names. So I've spoken to a lot of colleagues about this, and I was like, it's weird that we, many of us, if you know who Christine Jorgensen is, you know that she was the former G.I. George. Or Lily Elba was Ina Wagner. And why do we know that, and why do we keep using it? You know, it gets dropped in articles quite often as though it's this like extra fact, but in today's day and age, we get quite upset when someone uses a dead name. And I don't think it adds any content to the actual article itself whenever it is used. So a colleague of mine said it's quite strange, you know, he comes from a more religious background, and he was like, you know, Mother Teresa, in a sense, has a dead name. So does Pope Francis, but we don't know these things. Nor are we obsessed by them, nor do they mark a kind of secret life that we need to know about. So what I began to think was that perhaps then I need to take some sort of citational license. When I was reading up about this stuff, I came across a tweet, which is generally a bad way to start something, but... someone called Caitlin Burns said, literally no other group of people has a mass of assholes insisting on using a name they no longer want to be used. The only purpose of intentional dead naming is harassment, no matter how good faith you think it is. I started to think, are we those assholes? So I then decided if I'm going to cite any of this, I'm going to start redacting the dead names. And so I started taking some citational license. Fine, take the dead names out. But then we have the problem of the actual websites, right? Because you start a trail, and then you allow people to begin to access this trail. So for me, then, when you begin to look at these articles, the dead name is the least of the concerns. Many of the articles, and I'll get to talking with Zahara later, that they speak about her genitals quite openly. They post pictures, they'll steal pictures from either Instagram or Facebook, and literally they'll just put the Facebook photo and their name underneath as though they've made an article when they haven't. They will say, so she, and I'll show the image later, she made a video saying trans women are valid, and they made a headline saying, Miss Sahara has new boobs, says trans women are valid. She is at constantly, and she says quite clearly that she feels she is at war through the internet with the Nigerian tabloids and the state. So one of the favorite things that they do with her is that they show a stream of very, very beautiful pictures of her and then random men. So none of the pictures that they show of men are actually the same man, ever. And the headline will pop up after like scrolling for at least three pages and it'll just say, but she was a man. And that is like a weird version of catfishing, because at some point you think this is a really attractive woman, cis woman, and then you figure out that, and it creates that kind of, it helps to ignite the kind of homophobic and transphobic fear that is already very pervasive in Nigeria. So Addie Kunzman, in her book Figurations of Violence and Belonging, Queerness, Migranthood, and Nationalism in Cyberspace, in a footnote adds that she actually doesn't provide any of the URLs for the work that she does in her book. So there is some sort of precedent that perhaps we don't have to provide full citations. Sadia Hartman asks, in talking to her own archives of scandal and excess, we need to ask ourselves questions about absence in the violated bodies and who we cite and what this tells us about the narratives we want to portray. So coming from the space that I do and working with the people that I do work with, I draw from African feminist thought in particular, and I believe it's crucial that intellectuals consider how we validate archives, usually the dominant ones, and provide forms of power. Danai Mapotsa refers to this as a key element of African feminist thought. Following this, Neo Musangi urges us not to reinscribe our variously condemned statuses, to not use our power in the service of the archive that would do more harm than good. For Musangi to write about gender nonconforming people from the African continent and about themselves as a gender nonconforming artist, one has to become what they call undisciplined. And that is to say, resist what would be easy, which would be just to publicize this archive and all its details. So I really like to kind of, in thinking through this issue with these people as kind of my interlocutors, I began to ask, you know, what if I didn't answer these questions? For most people, the archives that they work with are the archives of dead people. And so no one's holding them accountable, apart from the odd person who might be, you know, write the academic critique somewhere in an obscure journal that you as the original author may never read. So I know Zahara, and I thought, okay, so if I can't do this, maybe I should just ask her what she thinks about this. So I contacted her, and I was in London recently, and we went for a drink. And what came to mind is this quote from Kagura Machera, who says that we often have routine despair, and he works in queer African studies, routine despair about the ways in which the kind of queer African archive is used, and that the writing that we do cannot intervene in real-world situations, especially in moments of crisis. Go to this person. And go to her I did. So, Sahara and I met in a pub in Clapton Pond. she, you know, it's a side issue of other ethics working with trans people. When you're a trans person, there's that weird saying that one person can pass, but two together are definitely going to be clocked. Sahara is ridiculously beautiful and was going to a club afterwards because she'd had a series of very bad Tinder dates and like needed to release or something. So walked in this like short red dress. I recognized that I had planted myself near the men's bathroom door, so quickly like shuffled to the other side of the room thinking this is going to be hugely problematic. She wanted sparkling water. We begin to talk, and we do that thing that as an African trans community who know each other do, which is talk about lovers, exes, Tinder, and then court cases, rights progression, and then jokes about like idiotic leaders, and in that order. And obviously the divide between us is obviously my whiteness and an access to a passport that allows me to return to a continent that she cannot go to at the moment. But there are three interesting things that Sahara told me. Firstly, that the dead name that is being used, right, is actually not her dead name. But she appreciated my efforts to redact it. And she requested that I keep doing that, but that I footnote that this is actually a fake dead name because she wants a precedent to be set around the ways in which the archives of trans women, particularly because there is this interest in sexualization around it, what happens from here on out. Secondly, that the struggles over citation are not only an issue of the African continent. And Sahara is quite proud about her Nigerian heritage. So she told me that the Ladyboy documentary that I mentioned earlier, when they filmed it, they didn't tell her what the name of the piece was going to be. And she only found out after it had been released on Sky. Then they told her they were going to call it Ladyboys. And when she complained, they said, well, we have to draw an audience. It's ridiculously widely watched. I mean, it's a bunch of beautiful women going to Thailand to compete. It's every weirdo's fantasy, I suppose. So she was like, I want you to footnote that that is also, it's not just happening on the continent. I've been used in the UK media as well, and that's what, one of the reasons I refuse to work with the UK media, unless I know the person very well. And so she was quite supportive of all the steps that I took, but for me, that wasn't enough. And for her, it isn't enough either. But what was really fascinating is that she's well aware that she has an archive, she's well aware that she's leaving a legacy, and she's well aware that this legacy does not portray the truth of her. So in our discussions, we kind of came to a suggestion / decision that maybe I write this paper and she writes the end of it, which is a letter / a will to her archive. And so it's a way for her to be able to talk back to what has happened in the tabloid media and to provide guidance for the future. Done? Nearly. A way for her to provide guidance for anyone who would in the future use her archive, which is to say, redact, footnote, I'm giving this advice, this is what how I want it to be handled, and it's a way for her to speak back to the tabloid press because she's a refugee and a black woman and living in another country that she has no control over. And with that, yes, straight ahead.
So thank you for all these amazing presentations, and I invite all of you back to the stage for the questions and answers. Please, like, we have half an hour, and I think this talking among each other and creating question thing is not really working. We don't have enough time generally while explaining. So please try to just be precise about your questions and try to keep, like, at most 2 minutes. We will take questions and, yeah.
Anyone?
I'm Abigail. I use she, her pronouns. My question is for AC. The three narratives that you heard about Stonewall, can you give us an idea of how far apart those were, how long you lived with that interpretation, and where you got the new change, where you got the change from each place,
sure.
At each point?
Yeah.
So I would say it was maybe... I would spent 2 decades with Judy Garland, which is not a bad time to spend with Judy Garland, before I learned more about Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson. And then I feel like it's been fairly recently, within the last 5 years, that we've started to talk more about Storm Delivery. Yeah. Oh, and where did I learn those things? So clearly the first one is from a trans friend and queer elder. As I move forward, it was reading, and then more recently, I would say it's thanks to doing archival work and listening to some of the wonderful podcasts that have been coming out using archival material.
Hi, I'm Aaron DeWore from the Transgender Archives. We did a show with Chris Vargas, the Motha show, and he showed some of those graphs that you showed. And I just wanted to say that they are art. And for those who are not familiar with his work, that the huge changes in the percentage of people doing this and that, that's all art. Those are not actually facts.
Right. Well, and I think that that's actually one of the points that, given time, I wanted to go into a little bit more, which is that we're also in a process of when we look at particularly trans archives, this moment of, because it may be non-existent, right, using artistic interventions to start to counteract, disrupt, or reincorporate is an important moment. So MUTHA is really wonderful because it is that blend of historical artifacts, right? There are things that are there in addition to things that are imagined or reimagined. Yeah.
Hi, thank you all for your wonderful presentations. I had a question for B. There was a question in one of your slides, if trans people don't create their own archives on the continent, I mean, what did they do? And I was just wondering about maybe Ms. Sahara's own archive, digital archive, that maybe she's setting up herself using social media or other means. Can you maybe go into that a little bit?
Sure. So there are, I'd say, about 10 people from the African continent all over Europe and North America who have begun creating various kinds of digital work. Ms. Sahara, and I think this is particular to perhaps trans people from the African continent, Facebook is still really important. So a lot of her content is on Facebook. But recently her page got deleted, so that entire history disappeared and she had to start a new account. She does run a website linked to a kind of semi-official organization called Transvalid, but that is more of a space where she reposts. So a lot of the stuff that she is actively creating is usually through images of herself, because she believes that she has invested a lot in the way in which she looks and the possibility of that for herself. So it's a lot about imagery and then like talking to that imagery. But unfortunately, this is a way for her to communicate with people at home, but the way is it to have that, so the disappearance of that archive and the kind of, it's like non-reality in a sense, is quite difficult to gauge. And she's really upset about the Facebook page just disappearing.
Thank you so much for your wonderful presentations. Yutaka, I had a question for you. I know you spoke about the difficulties with the institution in terms of, you know, pushing the boundaries. What I was quite interested in knowing is what was the reaction or responses from colleagues or peers of yours, particularly to the work that you're doing within the institution, and whether there's a difference.
So I started working last year since April 2018, and when I did an interview, so a year before, they asked me like what kind of exhibition you want to do, and since my primary focus is queer film studies, so I said, well, something about queer, and even before I started working, they said, well, Mr. Kubo is a LGBT person, so I said, well, I mean, I don't represent everybody, right? I mean, I might be gay, but I don't represent, you know, every LGBT. And so my colleagues were very open-minded, and so I'm the only one who works with film studies, and the other people are theater people, European theater, Japanese theater, and traditional Japanese theater, so like kabuki and joruri. So they've been giving me ideas, like, you know, this can be used in your exhibition, you know, you can maybe talk to this person, this scholar. But the biggest problem that I have is that we have, I think, 40 or 50 volunteers who do a guided tour from Friday to Sunday, and they are like everyone is more than 70 years old, and they have been telling me that, you know, we have no idea what you are trying to do with the exhibition, and you know, if you do this exhibition, you know, there's no way that we can, you know, help the visitors, you know, go through that archive. And some way I can understand it, but I mean, I will provide, I so what I say to them is, I will provide every information you need so that you can explain, you know, why we are going to, why we exhibit this, like what's the importance of this piece. But so that's one way. And the other one is, I mentioned in my presentation, the university is trying to use our museum and our next, you know, 2020 exhibition as a way to, you know, promote itself to the world. Although we have new new dean, like, and he has no interest in culture at all, so he's like cutting down the budget for the exhibition, and we had about 220. We had about 50,000 euro for exhibition this year and last year, but they are going to cut down the cost, I mean the budget, to like 10,000 euro. And we could do exhibition with the materials that we already have, but we usually ask like young queer filmmakers to, you know, ask them to use, have us use, you know, their videos. But, you know, with 10,000, I mean 10,000 euro, like whatever we can do is very small. So at the moment, I'm not sure like what we can do in 2020. But yeah, thank you.
This question is for the panel as a whole. I was noticing, B, you spoke about the phobic use of a trope of madness, and then Aaron pointed out that Chris Vargas's graphs are creative rather than quantitative. So it led me to wonder whether you have anything to say as a group about the potential traction, whether it's creative or conceptual or political, of embracing and working with the part of trans representation and history that is about being a little bit unbalanced. And part of this question comes from the fantastic work that's collected in the recent anthology Trapdoor, that's the Eric Stanley and Raina Gossett and Johanna Burton, thank you, book that contains quite a lot of primary source material that's about saying, like, look, we don't necessarily have to claim a right to exist by performing being sane all the time. What have you got to say about that?
So I think that must be nice in the global north. like, we don't have the luxury of that. Even the DPATH movement is problematic for us. Most, particularly in East Africa, most East African trans people will tell you, why should I burn the bridge that you all got to cross? So it may seem revolutionary, great to kind of take on or play to the trope of madness or not perform in a particular way, but when you're largely criminalized and trying to survive, you know, most people are either trying to leave the continent or are in refugee camps or are in stealth, unless you're living in South Africa and now Botswana as well and Mozambique. But yeah, so I theoretically it seems great and a wonderful idea, but I think right now that's a kind of privileged position, and most trans people are just aiming for a sense of survival, which includes portraying normativity.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we see as a theme that is the level of unpacking that we need to do, particularly from an archive perspective, is the level of violence that's associated with that. So I really appreciate your response, B, because I think that even living in the global north, the amount of violence that comes up when you start to actually unpack particular trans narratives is overwhelming. Even since I've been here, every time there's been a trans panelist, usually the first question is about trans violence. We have to navigate that somehow, and whether we highlight it because we need to highlight that there is violence, or we need to start to be able to come to some kind of collective recovery, healing, acknowledgement, and support around that violence, there has to be a moment there. That book is a fantastic collection, and I think that particularly the Dean Spade article, that the Imagined Futures, where they have this conversation particularly about violence, but also noting that the violence was so ingrained in being part of the trans identity that we didn't have to discuss it because it's already assumed. right? Our lives are already going to be violent. And that's clearly something that is connection globally, right? And how we navigate that is, I think, going to be based on our particular communities.
Hi, my name is Eike. Thank you again for this amazing panel. I have a question to AC following up actually on the title of your presentation, because you mentioned scars.
Yeah.
And then you started up by saying, like, the archives that we're talking about are suturing together histories. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if that actually is a metaphor, or I mean, beyond sort of a sort of visual representation of scars, if this becomes a metaphor for also your museum work, to think of how scars, yeah.
Yes.
Work.
How's that as an answer? Yes, as an answer, that sounds great. Yeah, absolutely. And so I think for me, this idea of also being public with our scars, right, and referencing this moment around violence is something that is of interest to me. My work that I'm working towards is about this idea of collective trauma within trans communities and how we share that collective trauma. And I'm at the beginning of that, to be very frank with you. And so what that looks like in public spaces, museum spaces, and in archives is still something that is unfolding for me.
I have a question. Thank you all for your presentations first. This is a wonderful panel. But AC, I got a question for you.
Yes.
You talked about, when Aaron brought up the three graphs, you presented them as though they were fact, and then you glibly said they're not, they're interpretation. I'm having trouble with that.
Yeah, so I apologize for my nervousness. I was not looking at my notes when I got to that particular section, and I'm thankful for Aaron correcting me on that one, because I had written into my notes that these were tongue-in-cheek graphs of representation, and then when I got in front of you, I proceeded to not say that. And so that is my apologies for not managing my own anxiety.
Hi, everybody. I've got a couple of questions, but essentially it's around this idea of access and responsibility to information that surrounds letting people into our trans lives through collections and archives. I've built a collection of over 250 objects donated by trans people with their stories attached to them called the Museum of Transology. It's been on display now for 3 years. And it's going to finish being exhibited at Brighton Museum and Art Gallery in November, and I have to think about where I'm putting it and where I'm going to hold the collection. One of the places that's been suggested has been the Bishopsgate Archives, the radical socialists, they have working class histories, etc. Trans people don't need to show ID to get into the archives, which is, for me, opens up that access. But of course, if we put it in there, then anyone can go in. And it's got materials ranging from my boobs and formaldehyde in jars to people's intimate objects to emotionally triggering things about self-harm, etc., etc. So I want to just open up a conversation about how do we grasp or tackle or start thinking about who we're giving access to in these archives, and whether you've got any ideas about managing responsibility for that, or techniques, or maybe even literature surrounding these ideas that you could recommend.
So first, thank you. I think that this was a reference, I mean, also referencing kind of what Bea was talking about with having accounts deleted, moving between having material objects safe, supported, and cared for, or moving them digitally and risking everything going away is a very difficult moment. I think that right now, in terms of my area of expertise, I don't have necessarily a great response in terms of access for that right now, as long as it's someplace that can still be maintained in the long run. So I'm going to defer to maybe my colleagues for this one. Yeah.
Thanks. First of all, I follow you on Instagram. It's amazing. and I think the museum is amazing. So part of the work that I'm concerned about is that I don't have an archivist, right? And I feel like archivists take on the responsibility of some of our ethics, right? They like that pivot point where they're like, who gets access and who doesn't get access, and how people have access to things and what's redacted. So there is something, and Aaron was talking about it earlier, about having a great librarian. So I hope you have someone at Bishopsgate who's going to work with you or is willing to think through this kind of stuff with you, because that's, I mean, a physical repository is not really my area, but I do, what I notice in my work is the lack of archivist means the lack of a kind of control person. So that is the only thing that I could speak to. But I have a friend who runs an archive, and you could talk to him because he's pretty clever about that stuff.
We have time for a couple of more questions.
Thank you. My name's Eliza. I would like to ask you all about privacy, because I think it's very related to the question of access and care that we discussed in the trans focus number one. And you know, what is private about private parts? It's a legal question, for one, and a safety issue. But for me, I'm like, but people are creating things and they are sharing them, and there's something integral to that process. So I just kind of wondered, because it seemed like all of you were talking about examples like where the pop-up is an intervention, because it's also like something that can't entirely be captured. You had to have been there. And the temporary exhibition that you're planning, I mean, yes, it's maybe not something that will have a long-term impact because it's not a part of the permanent collection. But I just kind of wondered if you would speak to about the negotiating of privacy through the format. And I have to say, I'm very interested in this, like, as a structural question, because, I mean, privacy is something that doesn't actually exist. it was only through certain structures that some people have access to privacy, and trans people do not. It is not an entitlement. It is not a part of actually living a trans life. So I just kind of wondered about that as something that was maybe really integral to the question of an archive and giving something away and wanting it to be cared for. That's like an extension of, I think, somehow of a transition. So, okay, this is a bit rambly, but it's something that I feel like as you're all kind of working with or struggling with.
So at the Tsubochi Theater Club Museum, when we get donations from people, that's either before the person who has the collection passes away or after he or she or they pass away. And before the owner of the collection passes away, we usually ask them if we can use the donation in any ways we would like to exhibit. So in my case, as a film scholar, we ask them, you know, can we provide alternative interpretation of certain texts that you have but no one has said before? And if they say yes, we usually mark that in a format, and when we use it in an exhibition, we can do pretty much any way we want to. But about the trans collection, I didn't mention this in my presentation, but we do have few trans collections from kabuki performers, and this one is very, very touchy, risky. So we usually have to go through a long negotiation with the family that the donation came from. And usually kabuki performers, they do not accept they do not acknowledge any presence of trans people. So it's basically dead collection in our museum. And the Japanese studies, and especially kabuki studies, as I said, they are very transphobic as well. So they usually don't, we know it exists in our collection, but we cannot tell visitors or scholars like whose collection we have. I mean, we can say like there's something, but we cannot tell them. And we usually don't allow access to outside scholars, they need to apply in advance, and then we can let them go inside our archive. But that's something when we have scholars from overseas, they usually don't know our procedures. So when someone wants to see the Kabuki collection and trans collection, we usually tend to have a big problem. So.
So I think I have two responses to it. In the Fuller paper, I have an interest in the fact that Zahara, on all the platforms she uses, has no privacy settings, right? And that's an interesting thing, that she has the option for a kind of privacy but doesn't have it, even though she knows that they're taking everything from her. But she's quite clear that, I think that there is a trend around this with trans women living outside the continent. So there is a trans woman in Sweden who recently posted videos claiming that she was pregnant, and it was picked up by the Zimbabwean media, and she then posted a video saying it was quite hilarious that they actually believed that she was pregnant. It was like kind of like, jokes on you, you idiots, what do you know about transness? So there is that kind of tense conversation that's happening, but also that privacy, if you look at the African Union documents, is not the same as it is in the global north. So here it's an individual, it's individualized, there it's communal. So that's some of the issue we have in getting LGBTQ rights passed, because often in the global north it's been based on individual privacy. And that doesn't always work legally on the African continent. So there is then a tension. And so we see that with a problem now around internet rights. And, states like Nigeria, you get warned not to use Grindr in Nigeria because they do... they're able to kind of track your usership because of the questions of privacy. So there are many layers to this idea of what privacy means and how people are going to engage with it.
We have two more minutes, so we can be quick or cut it here. So I go with my question if everyone is okay. What I actually realized after listening all of you is B was talking about Zahar's archive was not portraying the truth of her. So I was asking what kind of archives and truth we are seeking, because it's what I see there is actually a real queer archive. It's really ephemeral. It is really, fragmented. It is but some part is fake. So there is not really a truth that we claim in the way we know the archives. And then Yutaka was talking about the film history in Japan and now rewriting the film history in a queer perspective with this film seems queering the film history in a way. So I was really excited when you say that queer youth will be able to use those maybe films, images, something to remake what new stuff. And you were all actually talking about what we know as collective memory even can be more fragmented and it changes. So I feel like we somehow bring all these queer perspectives to relation to memory and history and archives. And yeah, I would like you to comment on that, because I feel like this ephemerality is already in the queer archive, queer memory, or what I see and thought as queer memory. And I would like to have a couple of words from you.
So I think that you're right. I think that when we start to look at what queer memory is, there is this kind of ethereal quality, which is why I think it's also so important to be able to think about what we're holding on to and how we're presenting it, right? So unlike folks who are doing an active archive right now, what I'm interested in is how are we disseminating that archive, and then how do we integrate and talk about it again, right? Because those are going to be some of the moments that we hold on to. So when we think about what kinds of things that we're holding on to. So for example, if we're holding on to news stories that are focused around tabloids, then that's one thing that we're saving, but we're also missing out on all of these other kinds of experiences, right? And so where we're highlighting that.
One of the things that I'd hoped to mention in my talk but didn't quite get to is that we also leave out stories around things like sex work and policing and healthcare and things like that. And what we wind up doing is focusing our memory on these particular moments that in some ways are still disembodied from us in terms of what we need to talk about. So I can hope that with a queer archive and memory and what we're presenting, that we can start to get a little bit more of the tangible daily experience in there in some ways.
Japanese film history has been like written by usually white men and in the 1970s and 1980s, and now they are in like their 60s and 70s, and they say, well, Japanese film history doesn't have any queer perspective. Well, that's your fault for overlooking, right? Whenever I go to a conference like SCMS, I say, well, you are the one who didn't mention this in this book, blah, blah, blah. But so what I wanted to do with bringing back the softcore gay porn is that the filmmakers who were making those films weren't, they say they weren't like queer identified, but actors, they were. Most of them were actually like gay identified men, and that kind of information is like revealed after I did some research. But I found it very interesting how those gay actors were actually acting their imagination on the screen when they couldn't do their imagination come true in their own actual lives, and their imagination is actually reflecting the social discourses like such as AIDS and HIV. And to me, as a queer film scholar, going back to see those memories and maybe excavating those memories that other white men film scholars have overlooked helps us actually reconstruct Japanese film history through the queer perspective. So it's fun. Yeah.
So we have a tension currently where we're still trying to figure out what that having a queer archive means in relation to particularly people who identify as trans and have an ongoing issue of separating themselves out from gay and lesbian people, because trans people are most often on the African continent just seen as your most visible gay or lesbian person. So, and even queer African studies, which is kind of developmental stage, is still we're trying to figure it all out. So sure, there's like an ephemeralness, and I think that there is something to be said for the kind of truth and lie that is happening, both in Sahara's archive, in the archive of the pregnant trans woman, and there are many, there's currently a Ghanaian trans woman who has released a Nollywood film and is now claiming to be the first Nigerian trans person, even though historically there is a first Nigerian trans person. She's already in the media. So there's this consistent kind of truth and lie element to it, which is, I think, part of the broader work. And ask me the question in 2 years, and maybe I'll figure it out.
Thank you. We're beyond the time. I take the priority of being my moderator. And thank you, everyone, for the panel.